From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Tony Awards are this Sunday night. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Harry Connick Jr. He's nominated as Best Actor in a Musical for his performance in the Broadway revival of The Pajama Game. The cast recording has just been released. We'll talk with John Lasseter about directing his new animated film, Cars. He also directed Toy Story and A Bug's Life and is now the Chief Creative Officer of Disney. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews CDs by two bands who he says make the so-called classic rock genre sound fresh again. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Terrorist, the new novel by John Updike. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Tony Awards ceremony is Sunday night. My guest, Harry Connick Jr., is nominated as Best Actor in a Musical for his performance in the revival of The Pajama Game. The show received 8 other Tony nominations, including Best Revival of a Musical. This was Connick's Broadway debut. He's best known for his jazz, piano, and vocal recordings, and for his recurring role on Will and Grace. He's from New Orleans and has been active in attempts to rebuild the city. In fact, next week there will be 5 benefit performances of The Pajama Game, and one of the 3 groups that will divide the proceeds is New Orleans Habitat Musicians Village, which was co-founded by Connick and Branford Marsalis to help musicians who lost their homes in the flood. The run of The Pajama Game was extended through next week to accommodate these benefit performances. The cast album of the revival has just been released. Here's Harry Connick singing one of the show's best-known songs, Hey There.
Hey there, you with the stars in your eyes. Love never made a fool of you. You used to be too wise. Hey there, you on that high flying cloud. Though she won't throw a crumb to you, you think someday she'll come to you. Better forget her, her with her nose in the air. She has you dancing on a string. Break it and she won't care. Won't you take this advice I hand you like a brother? Or are you not seeing things too clear? Are you just too far gone to hear? Is it all going in one ear and out the other?
Harry Connick, welcome back to Fresh Air and congratulations on your Tony nomination.
Thanks, Terry.
The Pajama Game is your first Broadway show. You did South Pacific for television, but this is this is on Broadway. What's different about being on Broadway? What did you have to learn that you'd never done before?
Well, the strangest thing for me was leaving the stage, you know, because when I do a concert, I'm on stage the whole time, and there's a relationship that you develop with an audience that is very delicate and very wonderful and always changing. So that's something that I really enjoy. And on Broadway, even though you're not necessarily playing to an audience, there is still a relationship there of sorts. And then all of a sudden you finish your scene and you walk off stage and you're back in the real world, you know, backstage. And it's a strange, different sort of reality. I had to kind of get used to that. But that was kind of the only thing, you know. And also, I don't think of like me in this show as carrying this show, like as opposed to when I'm on my bandstand, you know, if I have a bad show or if people don't like the show, it's because of me. It's not because I can't blame anybody else. But, you know, like on Broadway, we're all equal performers. You know, it's not like, I mean, I may have the name on the marquee, but it's still an ensemble work.
You know, Sinatra has been such a big influence on your singing. Do you think of yourself as having consciously emulated him?
At one point I did. You know, there's a slew of musicians that not only did I emulate, but I imitated. I mean, I think any young artist goes through a process when they imitate the masters. You know, you can go to the Louvre and see all of these painters in there sitting in front of the great master paintings, painting them exactly as they are. I mean, that's how you learn. I think any artist can tell you that. And it goes beyond just emulation. I think that's the secondary part of the process, the first part being imitation. You try to be exactly what these people are. And when I was 18, 20, 22, this is what I tried to do. I mean, Louis Armstrong, Thelonious Monk, Frank Sinatra, James Booker. I mean, these are people I wanted to be, not even be like. And as time goes on, you become an adult and you become more confident in your own skin. And the things that you picked up from those people sort of fade into the background and your own personal style comes through, probably never losing what you were influenced by from a core perspective, but the specifics sort of drift away, and then you develop your own style.
One of the things I liked about seeing the Pajama Game, you know, I knew a bunch of the songs from the show, but there were a few really good songs that I didn't know, including one called A New Town is a Blue Town, which you get to sing,
yeah.
And it's a beautiful ballad. Do you want to say anything about why you like the song before we hear it? And
sure.
And did you know it before the show, before you were in
the
show? I
had never heard the song, A New Town is a Blue Town, until I signed on to do the Pajama Game, and I love it. It's actually my favorite tune in the show. The melody is different sort of structurally than all the other songs. It has a different feel to it. It almost feels like a song that was written by Duke Ellington. It sounds very much like a Frank Lesser song, My Time of Day from Guys and Dolls. It has a certain blues quality to the melody, and it's a little bit atypical, and it's really fun to sing, and it's compared to the other songs in the show, a little bit more discordant, and it represents what the lyric is saying, which is, it was my choice to come to this new town. Nobody likes me here, but I'm going to stick it out, and I'm going to make it what I need it to be. And it's really a great piece of music.
Well, here's Harry Connick from the new cast recording of The Pajama Game singing A New Town is a Blue Town.
A new town is a blue town. Who do you know? Show me what you can do, town. There's no red carpet at your feet. If you're not tough, they'll try to beat you down in a new blue town. The old town, it's not like the old town. You don't take long to find that you're in a cold town. But you know you can lick it. Didn't buy a round-trip ticket to this cold, cold new blue town. Well, nobody asked me to come here, and nobody asked me to stay. Made up my own mind, and I know that I'll find my own way. Since that first day when I said hi, town, they've damn well tried.
That's Harry Connick from the new cast recording of The Pajama Game. That's really a great recording.
Thank you.
Now, in The Pajama Game, you're cast opposite Kelly O'Hara, and you work really well together. Did you have to audition opposite each other, you know, to make sure that you would have some chemistry?
They like to do that. I mean, the chemistry thing, I guess, basically boils down to whether you like the person or not, and whether you other people think you could potentially have a romantic relationship with on stage. And Kelly's amazing. I mean, she's a highly skilled and trained musician and a brilliant, brilliant actress. And we have a lot in common. We're both from the South. We're both very family-oriented people. We like the same types of music, and we hit it off. I mean, from the first day, she's got a really cool sense of humor, and she's just my kind of girl. You know, she's the kind of person I like to hang out with, and we hit it off. And I think that was obvious to us, and it was obvious to everybody that was involved in the show. So there was no question in my mind that she would be the perfect person to play Babe.
Is there anything that you need to do to make sure that your voices blend together well?
Well, the thing about Kelly is, I mean, you're not going to out-sing Kelly O'Hara. I mean, she's an incredible singer, and she's not really going to... I don't think it's about blending so much. You know, like, there's a song that we sing this reprise of together in the middle of the show. And if I went toe-to-toe with her as far as going powerhouse, like, I mean, she's an opera singer. I mean, she wiped the floor with me, and she does every night on this particular song. And, you know, I come off stage and laugh with her about it all the time, but she, you know, I don't think she's thinking about blending. She's thinking about singing, and, you know, and if you can keep up with her, great, but she ain't going to slow down for you.
Are you thinking of There Once Was a Man?
No, although she did destroy me, and she does on occasion when we do that. There was one particular night I started singing this one line in a kind of a mock opera voice, which I have, you know, I don't have any skill at, and I don't know what I'm doing. And then she decided to throw it back at me, and she did, but it wasn't mock. It was a line that she sang in an operatic style and just absolutely crushed me. And that was, you know, she kind of winked at me like, are you sure you want to go there? And I said, well, maybe not. Maybe I should rethink that, because that's playing with fire, you know.
So what's the song?
It's a reprise of Hey There. It's right at the beginning of the second act.
Why don't we hear it?
Better forget her.
Forget him. Just take it all in your stride.
With her nose in the
Don't
air.
Let him make you fall apart.
A puppet on a string.
You've always had such
She won't care for me.
What to do?
What to do?
Where to turn?
Where to turn? Too much in love.
Watch your heart, old girl.
Is it all going in?
If you will,
and I'll be alone.
That's Kelly O'Hara and Harry Connick from the new cast recording of The Pajama Game. In the final scene of The Pajama Game, you and Kelly O'Hara appear as the pose in the immortal poster for the movie The Pajama Game with Doris Day. And the couple have married, and they're sharing a pair of pajamas. So the leading man is wearing the bottoms, and the leading lady is wearing the oversized top, which covers her bottom. And that's how you appear on stage in the final scene. And so when you come out in the pajama bottoms, bare-chested, the audience like gasps a little bit, because it turns out you have some pretty ripping muscles. And
now, how do you know that they're not gasping at Kelly's legs? Because if I were there, that's what I'd be gasping about.
Well, the muscles are kind of large, with no offense to her legs. but anyways, have you been working on those a long time?
Oh, I've been lifting weights probably since I was 14. I like exercising, and, you know, and I definitely concentrated my efforts when I knew I was going to have to take my shirt off on stage. I mean, that wasn't really in my program when I moved to New York, you know, to sign with Columbia Records as a jazz piano player. I didn't think I'd be taking my top off on 42nd Street. Of course, you know, depending on how my career went, I could have been taking everything off right down the street on 42nd Street, but that would have been a different line of work, I think, and a lot less money. Well, maybe not. I'm working at the Roundabout, so that's just...
Do those muscles come in handy for anything? I mean, you know, they're very impressive looking, but do you feel you actually like use them in daily life? Are they helpful at all in playing piano, or are they unnecessary for that?
As far as helping me play the piano, no, I don't think so. Helping me lift the piano, maybe.
And that's important.
Of course. If my piano playing career sort of comes to a spiraling halt, I'll be able to move pianos for a living.
My guest is Harry Connick. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Harry Connick. He's nominated for a Tony Award for his performance in The Pajama Game. One of the differences between performing in concert and performing on Broadway is that when you're in concert, you're either at the piano or you're in front of a microphone. And on Broadway, you're in character. So you have to figure out what to do with your body when you're singing.
Not really. No? I mean, I didn't. No? I just like when you're talking to somebody on the street, you don't have to think about what to do with your body. I don't think about what to do with my body when I'm on Broadway. You just act naturally, you know. That's what I do. I don't think there's a special set of motions or things that you have to do. That would take away from, I just act the way this guy I think would act. But what's very different is that there's no acknowledgement publicly of the audience. You know, that fourth wall, as they call it, is up. And you don't break it. At least I don't break it. And I don't really look at the audience. And it's hard for me. That's another thing I wanted to tell you about. What did I learn from being on Broadway? The first time I go out on stage for the first dress rehearsal, you know, my inclination is to communicate with the crowd. But you don't. There is no crowd in my office at the Pajama Factory. You know.
Right. So you have to ignore.
You ignore them. They're not there. Although their response sort of dictates a rhythm sometimes. You know, if they're belly laughing at a certain line you say, it's going to make you wait a few seconds before you say the next line, things like that. But it's an interesting sort of phenomenon, you know.
The Pajama Game has been extended an extra week in the Roundabout Theater production, and you're going to use that week as a benefit with proceeds to go to Musicians Village, which is a project that you organized with Branford Marsalis as part of Habitat for Humanity to help. I know it's New Orleans related, but why don't you explain it?
Sure. We have 5 performances, and they will be raising money for, in addition to some terrific Broadway charities. The most dear to my heart out of all of these charities is the New Orleans Musicians Village, which is, as you said, an idea that I came up with Branford in conjunction with Habitat for Humanity that is going to build houses and is building houses for musicians and other people who were victims of Hurricane Katrina, you know, people who lost their houses and had to move elsewhere. We just dedicated the first 3 houses about a week ago, and our hope is to create a new community where an old community was sort of falling apart even before Katrina. Now it will be something vibrant and new and prospering. There's going to be a school there called the Ellis Marsalis School for Music, which is going to be, you know, an actual place to go to formally have the tradition of New Orleans music passed on from one generation to the next. It will ensure that the culture and the tradition of New Orleans music will be able to go cross-generationally, and we're very excited about that. And it's going to be a place where people can live, and hope. My vision is that there'll be clubs there one day, and there'll be a clinic, and there'll be a post office, and I mean, these are things that, you know, they're dreams. But you know 9 months ago, Branford and I were sitting in the back of the car driving to Houston to the Astrodome to go visit some of the people from New Orleans that were staying there, and we said we need to do something, and this is what we needed to do.
How are your family and friends in New Orleans doing? Are they all back in their old homes or in new homes?
Well, Terry, they're all back, but it's depressing, you know. I mean, it's a city that's on the verge of bankruptcy. It's a city that's going through some very tough changes, and you know, it's, to be perfectly frank, it's a city that may not be a city after X amount of time. It's a city that needs a tremendous amount of help, a tremendous amount of political leadership and involvement and vision, and no one knows what the future of New Orleans is going to be. As much as we see Mardi Gras on the news and Jazz Fest and how wonderful a time all those things are, the bottom line is, 2 blocks away from these socially significant and wonderful festivities that we have, there's, you know, miles and miles and miles of neighborhoods that are not inhabited, and we've lost our tax base. The, you know, the transit authority, the regional transit authority is running out of money. It's just, it's not a good time. And you know, we're doing everything that we can. And I know that the government down there is doing everything that they can. It's just very scary for people who live there. There's not a lot going on. So, you know, with a lot of prayer and a lot of hope, hopefully we can, and a lot of money, hopefully we can rebuild that city and try to recapture its former glory.
Does your father plan on staying?
Oh, yeah. No, he's not going anywhere. He's been there 80 years.
What will you be doing after you close on Broadway?
I'm going in the studio, Terry. I'm making another record of a bunch of songs associated with New Orleans. There's songs that I've wanted to do for a long time that I just haven't done, and I guess I'm in the mood to do them now. Some are original, some are old-time songs. And then I'll go on the road in the fall.
Well, good. Well, Harry Connick, thanks for talking with us, and good luck at the
Tonys.
Thanks,
Terry. Thanks so much. I appreciate it. It's good to be with you again.
Harry Connick is nominated for a Tony for his performance in The Pajama Game. The award ceremony is Sunday night. The run of The Pajama Game has been extended through next week to include 5 benefit performances. To find out more about those performances or to hear music from the new cast recording, go to our website at freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Tell me.
I love you more than all the heroes in all the history books.
Tell me!
What a woman. I'll tell ya. There once was a man who loved a woman. She was the one he slew the dragon for. They say that nobody ever loved as much as he. But me.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble. Publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Art of War by Sun Tzu, in stores and online at bn.com. From IFC Films and the Weinstein Company, presenting Wordplay, a look inside the crossword puzzle phenomenon with New York Times crossword editor Will Shortz and others. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Race Cars with Personality. We talk with John Lasseter about directing the new animated film Cars. Also, Ken Tucker reviews new CDs by the rock bands Eagles of Death Metal and Rye Coalition. And Maureen Carrigan reviews John Updike's new novel, Terrorist. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. New albums by 2 bands, Eagles of Death Metal's Death by Sexy and Rye Coalition's Curses, feature hard rock influences from at least 30 years ago. Rock critic Ken Tucker says both bands make the so-called classic rock genre fresh again. And by coincidence, each album has been produced by different musicians who have been members of a much bigger name band, Queens of the Stone Age. Here's the opening of the CD by the Eagles of Death Metal.
For a side project from a member of Queens of the Stone Age that can sound like a joke band if you don't listen carefully enough, Eagles of Death Metal sure is, well, great. Guitarist and drummer Josh Homme from Queens of the Stone Age reunited with a childhood pal, Jesse Hughes, who was going through a bad divorce and writing rock songs as therapy. The two formed Eagles of Death Metal, the very name a joke that nonetheless suggested both intensity and a soaring playfulness. Little Richard, James Brown, and T-Rex were prime inspirations, as are middle period Rolling Stones and half-forgotten boogie bands like Savoy Brown and Foghat. How does all that sound when mashed together? Like this. Singer-songwriter Jesse Hughes is a hilarious eccentric, nutty and shrewd. He sometimes uses the stage name Boots Electric because he likes to dance while performing. He refers to his prodigious mustache as, quote, a soft boomerang of love. By contrast, Rye Coalition, a New Jersey quintet, plays it a bit more straight and ferocious on their pleasingly raw new disc, Curses. In Rye Coalition singer Ralph Cusseglia's voice, you can hear the strangled angst that informed the distinguished work of AC/DC, Kiss, and the noted archery and gun enthusiast Ted Nugent. But Rye Coalition adds its own mark to this genre of bash and roll. First of all, with a knowingness that never becomes arch or ironic, and a fierce rhythm section powered by the drummer David Anthony Lido. What both Eagles of Death Metal and Rye Coalition share, and they share it to the extent of touring together on some dates, is that they don't agonize or antagonize. They want to make music that especially pleases the female segment of their audiences, which is unusual among male bands who rock this hard. That's what the Eagles' album title, Death by Sexy, refers to, achieving musical romantic nirvana. Speaking of nirvana, Rye Coalition is produced by Dave Grohl, former member of Nirvana and a Foo Fighter who was also briefly a Queen of the Stone Age with the Eagles producer Josh Homme just a few years ago. Alienation, hostility, and free-floating antagonism have become so routine among newer hard rock acts as well as much hardcore hip-hop that simply by making party music, heavy on the beat, mindful of funk and blues rhythms, both bands locate the sensuality that transforms solid rock into something more rare. Good old rock and roll.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed new CDs by Eagles of Death Metal and Rye Coalition. Coming up, John Lasseter talks about directing his new animated film, Cars. This is Fresh Air. My guest, John Lasseter, directed the new animated film Cars. He also directed A Bug's Life and Toy Story, which was the first feature-length computer animated film ever made. He was the executive producer of Monsters, Inc., Finding Nemo, and The Incredibles. Lasseter was a founding member of the Pixar Animation Studio. This year, Disney acquired Pixar, and Lasseter is now Disney's chief creative officer. Every character in the new movie Cars is a car. The main character is a hotshot rookie race car named Lightning McQueen. On the way to a championship race in California, he accidentally winds up off the interstate on Route 66, where he drives into a small, forgotten town named Radiator Springs. The movie features the voices of Owen Wilson, Paul Newman, Bonnie Hunt, Cheech Marin, and George Carlin. John Lasseter, welcome back to Fresh Air. Why did you want to do a story about Cars?
Well, Cars is the movie is a really personal story for me. I grew up in Los Angeles, and I think anybody born and raised in L.A., it's part of their DNA to kind of like cars. But my dad was a parts manager at a Chevrolet dealership, so I liked cars even that much more. I would love to go to his dealership when the new models were released. It was always around the beginning of school, and they would paint the showroom windows white, and I couldn't wait to see the new models. And so I just have always loved cars. And so it's really kind of putting the two sides of my life and my family and my loves together, because my mother was an art teacher for 38 years, and I grew up loving cartoons. And so this is kind of putting the two sides of my loves together, cars and cartoons.
What about race cars? Are you interested in NASCAR?
I love racing, yeah. I live in Sonoma, California, and there's a racetrack called Infineon Raceway. It's where NASCAR comes every year. It's one of the two road courses, and I've gotten really in love with race, seeing races live. And there's an energy to being at a racetrack when the race is live. The sound, which the cars are so loud. There's no mufflers on race cars. And the speed, when you see these cars driving, it's like you can't believe they could drive that fast. And so all that energy, and I thought, I would love to get that kind of energy on the screen for the audience to see.
When you were growing up, your father ran the parts department of a Chevy dealership, and you worked there as a stock boy for a while.
Yep, I sure did.
Well, having a sense of like a real visual sense, what were some of the most interesting looking parts to you, and I'm wondering if any of those parts helped inspire any of the animation?
Well, I always loved the wheels were so interesting to me, because how a wheel can fundamentally change the way a car looks. Also, there's a back then, the muscle cars, you would get put much bigger wheels on them and raise them up in the back, and they became very kind of muscular that way, you know. And then as cars kind of evolved, the way they looked like muscle cars is you would lower them and they became more like street racers and stuff. And the tires kept getting thinner and thinner and thinner, and the wheels kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, where it looks like it's just kind of black spray paint on the outside of a chrome rim now. And so the wheels always inspired me as to how that can fundamentally change the way a car looks.
Now the main character car is a young race car that ends up by mistake on Route 66 and kind of gets trapped in this small town. And, you know, the race car, like all race cars, is there's logos on the car. There's logos. It's like race car drivers, their clothes are filled with
right.
logos.
So you have the sponsors.
The sponsors, yeah. So you had to come up with sponsors for these right. imaginary race cars. And some of them are pretty funny. And one of them, the main sponsor for the main character car is Rusty's.
And Rusty's medicated bumper ointment and their new rear end formula.
Now is that Tom and Ray Maliazzi, the car
bet
tuck guys, doing
is.
The voices for that?
You bet. I mean, I am a huge NPR fan, and I listen not only to Fresh Air, but I listen to Car Talk all the time. And I thought, I'm doing a movie about cars being alive. I can't do it without getting Click and Clack as voices. And so we had talked to them early on. And out of thinking of them and their show and you know, being from Boston and stuff, and how cars just rust out in Boston, I thought, this would be so great to get these guys in there. And so we thought, well, they kind of are these guys that own a garage that sort of made up this kind of preparation H for the automotive world that takes care of and soothes that painful rust that the Northeast cars kind of get. And out of that came the idea of a rust ease, you know, medicated bumper ointment.
Now, when you asked Tom and Ray Maliazzi, the Car Talk guys, to be voices in the movie, did they say yes right away? Because one of the things they're famous for instance, is not leaving town a lot. So, you know, you'd think they would have jumped at this. But it wouldn't shock me if they declined at first, because I have a feeling they say no to a lot of things.
We called them, and in you know, we talked to them, and they, I think they kind of got interested. They were familiar with Pixar's other films like Toy Story and all that stuff, and you know, so we finally had a conference call where we're going to talk to them about that. I was going to talk to them about the movie. It became a 45-minute personal Car Talk episode. I was laughing so hard through this because I asked them the simple question, okay, what car would your brother be? Right? I didn't ask them, what car do you want to be? I asked them, what car do you think your brother should be? And that was 45 minutes of them talking about each other's cars that they've had through their life that were so hilarious. And, you know, and Tom, of course, always has convertibles. So they finally settled into a Dodge Dart convertible. And then his brother wanted to be a 67, you know, he said, oh, he's got to be a 67 A100 van, right? And it's a Dodge. And it was kind of cool because they settled into both Dodges because they're brothers. And we had so much fun with those guys. They were hilarious.
My guest is John Lasseter. He directed the new movie, the new animated movie, Cars. He also directed Toy Story, Toy Story 2, and A Bug's Life. Now, Cars is your first film since Pixar merged with Disney. And before that, the two companies had a co-production deal. So how does this change your working life?
A lot. Bob Iger, is the CEO of Disney, has asked me to be the chief creative officer of Disney Animation and of Pixar Animation. And so now I'm kind of overseeing, you know, all the productions that are being done at both of the studios. I'm also helping over at Walt Disney Imagineering and helping design future theme park rides. And I'm having the time of my life because this is what I've wanted to do all my life, is to make cartoons for Disney. And I got interested in computer animation, which led me up to the San Francisco area working with Lucasfilm, and then Pixar kind of grew out of that. And so to go back to Disney has been really exciting. And I worked through college at Disneyland as a ride operator on the Jungle Cruise. And so I've got the theme parks in my blood, too. And so it's really exciting to be back.
So what did you learn from working, from operating the Jungle Cruise ride in Disneyland?
I actually was really shy before I worked on the Jungle Cruise boat. And as you know, the Jungle Cruise is a ride that it takes you through kind of the jungles. And the operator does a narration for the whole thing. And more than any other ride at Disneyland, the operator is part of the ride because you have these phenomenally bad jokes to tell, right? And the worse they are, the better, is what I've learned. And so I actually learned a lot about comic timing from the Jungle Cruise because they had a captive audience every 8 minutes or so. And, you know, and so I learned, well, let me try delaying the punchline a little bit more. And it got funnier. Oh, and I went too far. It wasn't funny enough. You know, and I went back and forth and trying things, the energy, slowing things down. And it was amazing how much I learned about comic timing from doing the Jungle Cruise.
So what's one of the jokes that you had to tell? Did they script them for you?
Yes, there's a standard operating procedure spiel that you're supposed to do, but it's one of the lore of the Jungle Cruise, the skippers, is that you trade jokes and you learn about new ones. And one of my favorite jokes is as you come around a bend, there's an explorer. And his sort of native helpers, they're stuck on a pole, and there's this rhino that's kind of poking him, right? And or trying to poke him, and they're raising up every time the rhino rises. And you say, oh, here is the lost explorer, and you know, he's being led by the famous Hontus tribe. And, of course, the rhino is trying to poke a Hontus.
Oh, gee.
See? Huh? Yeah. It's really bad.
You were actually fired from Disney, weren't you? Or was that from Disney Animation or from Disneyland?
No. Thanks, Terry, for bringing that up.
Yeah, hey, anytime.
Just about forgot it. No. Yes, in fact, I was fired from the Walt Disney Studios. I was a young animator working there straight out of CalArts. It was a time when the Disney Animation Studio was being run by kind of animators that were the second tier animators during Walt's time. They were creatively in charge through attrition as opposed to talent, really. And all these young people were coming in from CalArts, and we were on fire. We had seen Star Wars had come out, Close Encounters, you know, the work of Scorsese and Coppola, and it just the cinema was changing, you know, and it's just like we're so excited about what we could do in animation. And these guys were threatened by us. I mean, classmates of mine were Tim Burton, Brad Bird, John Musker, and I can go on and on. Leaders in the industry today were all my classmates. We just wanted to do cool things, and I never stopped. I kept suggesting things right and left and trying things out. And I literally had one of the guys tell me, you know, if we want your ideas, we will ask you. Just sit down and do what you're told. If you don't want to do it, there's a line of people outside the door that will do it. And I thought to myself, whenever I'm in charge, I'm never going to say that to a young person who is so excited and trying to make the product better. And that it's interesting because so much of my management style at Pixar is made up of what I learned what not to do during that time. And so I never shut up, and that's why they eventually fired me. So, well, and I went off to Northern California and worked with Ed Catmull at Lucasfilm, and the rest is history.
Now, I read that your co-director on Cars, Joe Ranft, died in August of 2005, and I believe he collaborated with you on all the films that you directed. What happened?
Joe was heading to a retreat, and he got into a car accident on a coastal road and was killed in a car accident. And it's a big loss. Joe has been such a part of all of our films at Pixar, plus, you know, most of the major Disney films, too. He's one of the greatest story artists and story minds that's been around in the industry. And he also is one of the funniest guys you've ever met. He, in fact, did a lot of, he's a very good actor, and he did a lot of the temporary voices that we use kind of as we're making the movie. And sometimes his voices were far better than any actor we were trying to cast in the part. And so he became, you know, the permanent voice. And so he did the voice of Heimlich the Caterpillar in A Bug's Life. Wheezy, the asthmatic squeeze toy penguin in Toy Story 2, and lots of small parts through all of the movies. And, you know, he was with me. He and I went to college together. We both grew up in Whittier, though we met at college, and he has been a part of every minute of making of this film with me. So it's a huge loss to the studio and to the art form of animation.
What did it do to your ability to really enjoy these animated cars in your movie and enjoy their adventures and enjoy their racing, knowing that your good friend and colleague had died in a car accident?
The way I look at it is Joe wanted to entertain the audience with this movie. Every frame of this film has got Joe in it. So to me, it's more about looking at the audience and the smiles on their faces and how much they're enjoying this movie, knowing that's Joe. That's what Joe is giving those people. And that's what I think about with this film, that Joe wanted this movie to be good and really entertain audiences.
Well, John Lasseter, thanks so much for talking with us about your new movie. Thank you.
Terry, it's always great to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me on.
John Lasseter directed the new animated film Cars. It opens tomorrow. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews John Updike's new novel, Terrorist. This is Fresh Air.
Mm-hmm.
In the new novel, Terrorist, John Updike, one of the country's most distinguished writers, attempts to figure out what would make a young man from New Jersey who recoils from the thought of killing insects offer himself up as a martyr for the jihad. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
The world John Updike helped usher into being in the some 50-odd books he's written over some 50-odd years is the very same world he indicts in his latest novel, Terrorist. Updike, in his prime, was something of a swinger. This is the great man of letters, after all, who wrote about wife swapping in the suburbs and memorably wrested the subject of oral sex away from the dank domain of pornography and introduced it in his 1968 novel Couples into the respectable precincts of high literature. But in Terrorist, Updike's fictional attempt to enter into the mind of a homegrown, teenaged Islamic radical, the bill has come due for the long American cocktail party of easy sex, overconsumption, and political naivete. And Updike, once an enthusiastic participant, is paying up. In fact, he's all but donning a hair shirt and taking a vow of poverty, chastity, and obedience. For as Terrorist tells us, it's not really those fundamentalist bomb-building zealots out there whom America has to fear. Rather, the enemy lurks deep within our own morally flabby culture of fast food, fractured families, and easy credit. Terrorist is set in Philip Roth country, northern New Jersey, but it lacks the humor, at once manic and rueful, that Roth brings to this blighted landscape of tired suburbs and industrial warehouses. Ahmad Ashmawi Malloy is an 18-year-old senior at Central High, a factory of a public high school whose limp motto is, "Knowledge Pays." Ahmad's mother, Teresa, is a recovering hippie of Irish-American extraction who works as a nurse's aide and plays at serial love affairs. His father was an Egyptian exchange student who decamped when Ahmad was 3. When Ahmad turned 11, he fell in with a local imam who operates a storefront Islamic school. Ahmad was attracted to the rigor and paternalism of the imam's teaching. Now, as he's about to graduate high school, Ahmad catches the flickering attention of an all but burnt out Jewish guidance counselor, Jack Levy, who hopes to steer the young man into a junior college and away from the suspect career path the imam has pushed him toward, getting his operator's license so that he can drive large trucks. As a purely aesthetic experience, Terrorist is pleasurable enough. Updike's famed precision and elegance haven't diminished, and as always when I read him, I get a kick out of learning obscure but always appropriate vocabulary words like myutic that only a writer with Updike's zest for the language and sure touch would have the nerve to place in a sentence. But Updike's prose has never seemed more emptily out of sync than in this novel's odd renunciation of the halcyon days of his beloved hero, Harry Rabbit Angstrom. All but the stupidest characters, and they would be Ahmad's sexually omnivorous mother and Jack's binge eater of a wife, propound the same dead-end worldview that America has invited its own ruin. Thus, Jack reflects that America is paved solid with fat and tar, a coast-to-coast tar baby where we are all stuck. A teacher, originally from Barbados, marvels at the vandalism that infects Central High. In Barbados, we shared books falling apart and used both sides of tablet paper, every scrap. Education was so precious to us. Here in this grand building, you need guards as if in a jail, and the students do everything destructive. I do not understand this American hatred of decent order. Besides the hectoring tone that all these accumulated finger waggings create, Updike's screed against American culture, on the one hand, tells us what we already know, that a landscape overrun with McDonald's and ATM machines lacks gravitas, and on the other hand, doesn't tell us enough. Ahmad remains an enigma at the end of this novel, his pilgrim's progress from a lonely kid who finds solace in the Koran to a martyr willing to blow up the Lincoln Tunnel still a mystery. Dostoevsky and Conrad are still the literary gold standard in the Western canon on terrorists. They may not have had any idea either about what motivated them, but they created mordant worlds and peopled them with characters of palpable willfulness. Don DeLillo, too, managed such a trick in his brilliant rendering of Lee Harvey Oswald in Libra. When a John Updike tackles a subject like terrorism, serious readers pay attention because we hope something powerful or subtle will be evoked beyond the range of reportage or political analysis. But Terrorist sadly feels like a rant, an old man's book without an old man's wisdom.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed John Updike's new novel, Terrorist. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of A World Undone, The Story of the Great War, 1914 to 1918, by G.J. Meyer. From Picture House, presenting the Robert Altman film A Prairie Home Companion, with a cast that includes Woody Harrelson, Lindsay Lohan, and Meryl Streep, opening June 9th. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that more students graduate from high school ready for college, work, and citizenship. GatesFoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Neil Young's concert film, Heart of Gold, is out on DVD. He performs the songs that he wrote last year, right after he was diagnosed with a brain aneurysm. On the next Fresh Air, Neil Young talks about writing those songs. Join us for the next Fresh Air.